Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's program.
It created an environment where communities certainly were not trusting the police department, and the police department was sort of changing the way that they were doing policing.
Many people felt it was important to share what was gone. The tradition here, the industrial tradition, the cultural tradition, whole communities which are gone.
There is something about income and education that drive your health regardless of your race.
If we help others to digitize, with this comes responsibility for making sure that we are safe, and not only technologically safe, but also legally protected.
We report from Detroit this week, from this year's edition of City Lab, bringing together over 600 city leaders, including tech innovators, architects, artists, and activists, to discuss some of the world's most urgent urban issues. Over the next 30 minutes, we talk about race and health in US cities, hear how Chicago is targeting gun violence, and meet the composer who's created symphonies with the sounds of the city. Plus, we sit down with Estonia's president, who tells us why her country is embracing a digital urban future. And that's all coming up over the next 30 minutes, right here on The Urbanist, with me, Andrew Tuck. So, welcome to the programme where we're reporting from City Lab, the Global Cities Summit, organised by The Atlantic, the Aspen Institute, and Bloomberg Philanthropies. We dispatched The Urbanist producer, Carlotta Rabello, for this week's show, and before we listen to her report, I've asked her to step this side of the glass and join me in the studio. Carlotta, welcome to the studio. You're normally on the other side of the glass telling me what to do, and we sent you, though, to Detroit. First of all, tell us what City Lab was doing there and a little bit about this event for people who haven't been and don't know exactly what it tries to achieve.
What's always really nice about attending City Lab, you know, we do cover a couple of conferences here on the show through the year, is how they really do take the city that they're using as a host city each year and incorporate it into the program. And this is not only by different sessions in different parts of the city, but a lot of the speakers speak about the identity of the place we are in through the 2.5 days of the event. Now, they held the event at a hotel that is by the waterfront, but it had an amazing detail, which is this, elevated tramway, they call the People Mover in Detroit, that one of the stops was inside the hotel, or you could go from inside the hotel to it. And this is an elevated tramway that takes about 45 minutes to do the whole trip, and it gives you an amazing perspective of downtown Detroit that you're not able to get everywhere else. And it was really nice to be able to escape in between sessions and just to spend $1.30 to take that ride, and it gives you the impression you're also one of the skyscrapers through the town. It's a really, I think the place was very well selected because of that.
Now, over the years, we've had civic leaders, think tanks based in Detroit on the show, and they've told a story of a city coming to terms with a difficult past, but regenerating and doing many things right. Did you sense that when you were in the city?
You can definitely sense everyone that I spoke to and that I heard on stage as well. Everyone is very proud of the city and the way it's moving at the moment. And even, you know, from taxi drivers on my way from the airport to the city, everyone is extremely proud of how Detroit is rebounding. And you can still get a sense of that. The city gives you very much, you know, rising from the ashes type of vibe. I arrived in Detroit on a Sunday morning and I was staying downtown and I decided to go for a walk. It was the first time I was in the city and I wanted to see it. And it was like a ghost town. I didn't see one single person for at least 30 minutes until I crossed my eyes with someone else that wasn't inside the car. And when I got back to the hotel, I asked, oh, is this normal? Said, yes, it's Sunday. No one goes out in downtown Detroit. You, like, unless you work around here during the week, people don't walk around, which I found quite fascinating. But one of the events that they held was at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Detroit. And usually with these conferences, the evening receptions and the museums are used as a way kind of to jazz things up a bit and go to a nice fancy place. And this museum couldn't be more Detroit in a really good way. We arrived, there's a marching band playing outside to welcome you. The building is like this old warehouse that's just been retrofitted to be the contemporary art museum of the city with some pretty amazing pieces inside and a really impressive collection. But everything about it felt a tiny bit rough in a good way. And I think that couldn't tell you more about where the city is today than that example.
Well, thank you, Carlotta. Now, let's listen in.
Over the course of 3 days, over 600 city leaders called Detroit their home as they arrived in the city for this year's edition of CityLab. The annual Global City Summit tries to tackle some of the big urban issues of today, and this year was no exception. From how big tech companies can shape up the fabric of a city to the future of mobility, housing, and even art, all against the backdrop of a city that is in the middle of a profound urban transformation. One of the first people I met was Dr. David Williams. He's a professor of public health and also of African and African American studies at Harvard University. He presented a series of fascinating statistics highlighting how the quality of life in American cities is highly impacted by racial disparities. In essence, how racism makes people unhealthy.
In the United States, there are large differences in health by income and education. There are also large differences in health by race. Researchers thought for many years that the gaps by race were simply a function of differences in income and education across races. Now we know that life is more complicated. So if I look at national data for the United States by life expectancy at age 25, the gap in health between whites with a college degree and whites who have not finished high school is bigger than the black-white gap. And the same is true among blacks. The gap in health between blacks who have a college degree or more education and those who have not finished high school is bigger than the black-white gap. At the same time, at every level of education and of income, there still is a racial gap. So whites who have dropped out from high school live 3.1 years longer than blacks who have dropped out of high school. And among the college-educated, the gap is even wider. It's 4.2 years. So we have this very stunning pattern in U.S. data that African Americans or blacks who have the highest levels of education, a college degree or more education, they still have lower life expectancy than whites with a college degree, than whites who have attended college, than whites who have finished high school. So these data profoundly tell us there is something about income or an education that drive your health regardless of your race. But then there's something else about race that matters profoundly for health even after we've taken income and education into account. There are scientific studies, I can think of a study in England and studies elsewhere in Europe, as well as studies from the United States that shows if we go into a disadvantaged community and just change the neighborhood conditions, improve the neighborhood and housing conditions, we do nothing in terms of health, but just improving the quality of life in a neighborhood reduces levels of stress and improves health. So what it does, it broadens what we think of as health policy. Health policy is not only what happens when we go to see a doctor. It's not just what happens by the public health system, but policies in domains of life, like in community development, in neighborhood, in housing policy, in transportation policy, policies that lower stress and improve the quality of life, in fact, importantly, drive health. And it says to us that we need to take a broader lens of health and think of how policies in domains far removed from traditional public health are important in terms of improving the health of populations.
You mentioned about this housing project in Atlanta.
Yes.
Can you tell me a bit more about that?
So in the city of Atlanta, there's a dramatic example. It's called a purpose-built community in Eastlake. Example of how it is possible, it's feasible, it can be done if community and government and the private sector come together to completely change the opportunities in a very disadvantaged community. So Eastlake Meadows was an all-black public housing project 20 years ago with very high rates of crime, a $30 million illegal drug trade run out of this public housing project. 90% of the households there were a victim of a felony crime every year. The school was one of the worst performing schools. Only 5% of the students in the elementary school were performing at grade level. Only 13% of adults were employed. On every dimension you would look at, things were very, very bleak. Three parties came together. The Public Housing Department of the City of Atlanta came together with community leaders in that public housing project and a wealthy philanthropist. And they decided that they would completely transform the community. They tore down the public housing and built new mixed-income housing. Half of the units are still reserved for persons who qualify for public housing, so persons who are poor. The other half goes to individuals who are at market rate, and they have saturated it with a supermarket next door, with good access to leads for finding jobs. They have built what they call is a cradle-to-college pipeline of a high-quality early childhood preschool system, a high-quality elementary school, a high-quality high school. And today, the elementary school is one of the best performing in the entire state of Georgia, although 60% of the students at the school are poor. The crime has declined, violent crime, by 90%. All able-bodied persons are employed, and the quality of life has markedly improved in this community. And for me, it tells us that it is possible when we, multiple parties in a local community, come together and can work together to completely transform the quality of life of the community and give young children as well as adults a better future.
Now, from race disparities in the U.S., we move over to gun violence and look particularly at the case of Chicago. Rosianna Ander is the director of the Chicago Crime Lab, and she told me how the city is only now recovering from 2016, what it has been described as the deadliest year in almost two decades. In 2016 alone, Chicago registered 762 murders, 3,550 shooting incidents, and 4,331 shooting victims.
The U.S. really does have very high rates of gun violence. We're actually, as a country, not necessarily a more violent country. We're just a more lethal country, and that really does have to do with our gun violence. And Chicago, by U.S. standards, is actually sort of in the middle of the pack for big U.S. cities. But when you compare Chicago to the two other biggest cities, Chicago's the third largest city, to Los Angeles and New York, we really have a very long way to go. Since the peak in the early 90s in the U.S. for homicides, New York and Los Angeles have decreased their homicide rates by close to 80 to 90%. And Chicago, before 2016, had decreased it by about 50%. So still a long way to go. And then we saw this huge surge of 60% increase in 1 year. It was sudden and sustained. So Chicago lost a lot of ground in 2017. Things started to go back down, but not to the quote-unquote good old days of 2015. And even 2015, we still had a long way to go to get into the same sort of ballpark as LA and New York.
Now, what's interesting is that there's no way to exactly pinpoint why 2016 became that horrible year.
I think there are a lot of theories and a lot of sort of plausible things that might have contributed to the surge in gun violence. We had a change in police leadership. The superintendent was fired. We also had the absolutely devastating release of the Laquan McDonald shooting, which we now can officially call a homicide. The officer who committed it was convicted recently. That had a chilling effect on the community's trust in the police department. You also had an agreement with the civil rights organization, the ACLU, suing the police department to fundamentally change the way that they do street stops. So there was a sort of change in practice. And then the Obama Justice Department had announced that they were also launching a civil rights investigation. So a bunch of things sort of happened all at once. These different things could have had an impact. I think nobody knows for sure exactly which of those different things contributed to the increase. But I think collectively, it created an environment where communities certainly were not trusting the police department, and the police department was sort of changing the way that they were doing policing.
After a brutal year like that one was, what impact does it have on the city and for communities? Because it doesn't seem like it will help if there's already distrust to change it once you go through a year that has that increase in fatalities.
Yeah, no, it absolutely, I think, shocked the conscience of the city. You know, I think we saw people who really historically had not been involved in work to address gun violence in our city coming forward and really saying, what could they do to help? You know, I think the communities that were already hard hit really bore the brunt of the increase as well. And so I think in some ways, it was such a significant increase that it really did capture people's attention in a new way. And I think it has led to some new innovations happening and some new work that's happening. So I think that's sort of the positive, is I think people really do recognize that this is too important a problem to sort of wait for somebody else to fix it. So we had the sports teams collectively, the owners of five of the professional sports teams got together to make some investments, really data-driven and evidence-informed investments in strategies to reduce gun violence. You had the philanthropic sector sort of redoubling their efforts to invest in promising strategies. And you had the Department of Justice not only doing a civil rights investigation of the police department, but also bringing in national experts to work with the Chicago Police Department to really identify what more could be done to more effectively address violent crime. And I think that sort of collection of things is starting to really bear some fruit. And we are seeing the trends moving in the right direction, but we still have a very long way to go.
Do you think it's the role of local government to fill the gap when it comes to dealing with violent crime? Because certainly as much as federal government can do, it seems like it's an issue that needs to be dealt at a local level.
Yeah, no, so without question, the most fundamental job of government is to provide safety and security to its residents. That sort of threshold condition that government does need to be providing. I think the challenge when you look at what happened in 2016 was the increase was so sudden, it's very hard for the public sector to be nimble and move quickly. And so Chicago is not a city that has a lot of excess resources, and the city budgeting process happens, you know, a year in advance, so it's hard to sort of move resources from one place to another quickly. And so I think it's sort of a combination of the philanthropic sector and private sector as a stopgap, providing some flexible resources while the government agencies try to kind of turn the ship, if you will, and redirect their dollars into more effective places. And we saw both things happening. I think the city did start to make some really substantial new investments in smarter policing and technology and training at the same time that the philanthropic sector made some investments in social programs. We need both, but absolutely, the public sector really does have the responsibility, first and foremost, to provide safety.
Now, are you curious about that sound? Well, it's the sound of the very first engine that Henry Ford ever built. That was recorded by the composer Todd McCover, who's also a professor at the MIT Media Lab. He has a new project called City Symphonies, where essentially he writes new pieces for a symphony orchestra to play, where he incorporates sounds of the city along with the music. But let him explain it.
What's interesting about these projects, I think, in some ways, why I still find them so exciting, I could see doing this for a while, is that each city is different. And if I don't get afraid and go into the city with an open mind, literally what I've learned to do is go into a city with no preconception about what I'm going to find there and what sounds, what people, what stories, and we just discover what's there. So actually, what's so interesting is the form of each of these cities, whether it's, we started in Toronto, we've been to a beautiful little cities like Edinburgh, we did one for the festival, we did one in Lucerne, Switzerland, Perth, Australia, big cities in the US. Each one, the process and what came out of it was different. So for some cities, I mean, in some ways in Detroit, the most important question for everybody here is, what do we do now? You know, here's this incredible city with, in fact, a very rich history, where most things fell apart. You know, more than half the population left, the industrial base disappeared, many of the houses are literally gone, you know, they're vacant lots, but everybody's reinventing the city, and it's right at the point where, nobody knows exactly where it will go. So that was the important question, but in doing that, many people felt it was important to share what was gone. The tradition here, the industrial tradition, the cultural tradition, whole communities which are gone. So that did become part of the project. In a city like Philadelphia, where the country, the U.S., started, it's where the Constitution was written, the Declaration of Independence. It's a city steeped in history, but I was really interested in looking at what it meant that democracy started there and, like, what the heck is going on now? What do we do with our democracy? How do we, you know, is something wrong? Is it not wrong? If something is wrong, how can we take charge and do something else? So, yeah, each city is really pretty different.
If you try to go to a different city without any preconceptions and just kind of absorb everything, how do you know when you get a sound that you know you're going to use it for sure?
At the end of the day, that's as difficult a question to answer as it would be if you asked me, how do you decide that that's the right melody for your piece? Or how do you, I mean, a lot of times people ask, how do you know when your piece is over? And you know, you can talk about, well, you know, you had the right chord, but actually it's a very intuitive thing. So I think with the sound, it's really important for these symphonies that the sound is vivid and interesting and unusual on its own. So if somebody hears it who doesn't know the city, doesn't know the context, maybe can't recognize the sound, every sound that you put in still has to catch your ear. And actually, I always think it has to catch your ear pretty quickly. So within a second or two, something about the sound, even if it's subconscious, has to grab you. And it could be that its texture is unusual. It could be that it sounds like... I actually really like sounds that when you first hear them sound like one thing, and then a second later you realize it's something else. Often cars, if you hear them at first, sometimes in the right context, you don't know it's a car. You think it maybe it's the strings doing a tremolo, or it's a bass guitar, and then, you understand after it's a car. Or other things like birds or nature sounds. You could put, like going to a zoo, you could put all kinds of sounds in a context where you don't recognize them, and then, you do. So the sound has to be interesting. And then it's really great to make sure the sound is kind of unique as well. So there's certain sounds that if you don't listen carefully, there's some sounds which you'd have no idea where they came from. They don't tell you anything special about a place. But almost everywhere, if you just keep your ears out, you'll see it's something about the actual acoustics of the city is different. One of the things about Paris, you know, it's an old city, it's a quaint city, but it's actually one of the loudest cities in the world because the streets are very narrow. They're quite tall. You know, in the center of the city, there's almost no vegetation. So, you know, the sounds of the cars, the sounds of feet on pavement, of people talking, it's almost deafening. You'd think New York was louder, but actually in some ways Paris is louder. So there are unexpected things that happen when you open your ears to each city.
The way you end up composing these pieces for the city is usually by invitation. The city asks you to go and embrace the project. Is there a city, though, that hasn't invited you yet, that you are really curious about working with the sounds that might come up if you go there?
I would love to do one in Tokyo. I know Tokyo pretty well. You know, Tokyo is a gigantic city, but it's also very detailed, but each neighborhood has a particular character. It's both a very private city and also a mammoth city. And, you know, the Olympics are coming up, so people are thinking about projecting things. So I would love to work in Tokyo. I did get asked to do a project in Beijing. So I went about a year ago to do my first visit to Beijing. And actually, I was only there for 4 days. I walked around the city with... I used a binaural recorder, so the microphones go in my ears. And the recordings that come back sound unbelievably immersive. Like, you know, if you listen to them with your eyes closed later, it feels like you're there. I came back with enough recordings from Beijing in 4 days. I mean, the city fascinated me so much in many, many ways. So that's when I'm, you know, just really anxious to get going with the project. The other one that we just launched is we did a small project, believe it or not, in the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea this summer. And we've been asked by a group in South Korea that has a lot of contacts in the North to do a symphony that will create understanding and some new way of, especially young people, thinking about each other between the two Koreas. So that's one where the contrast between, you know, I haven't been to North Korea yet, I have been to South Korea, so that's another. But the amazing thing is, just like in every city, when I say I want anybody who wants to participate, I really mean it, because you learn so much from every single person about what they care about, what their city is. And I think every city has something special about it. So, I mean, I have other things to do, but I would do these anywhere.
If you can't see, we are not done yet. If you don't recognize the genius in refusing to be generic, if you still can't tell the difference between the boom and the bass, you've never been to Detroit. But don't worry, we'll still be here when you decide to learn.
At a time where more and more cities around the world are concerned about privacy laws and data protection, there was one speaker that stood out, Kersti Kaljulaid, the president of Estonia. She explained how her country has been part of a digital revolution for the past 20 years, where the national and local governments play a key role in giving every citizen a digital identity. Here she is.
At the turn of the century, we noticed that the private sector is starting to move their services online. Online banking already existed. Most bigger companies ran their board meetings online, and we wanted to bring our public sector up to that technological level. And frankly speaking, we didn't know that other governments are not doing so. And we didn't think that in other places people expect governments to fall behind technology. So we just did the same. We put our tax board online, and then our private sector took notice and said, you are doing this online, we are doing this online. Why not create a digital identity which everybody can use? Because it's much easier for people to remember one identification system than all varied ones, like separate one for your bank, separate one for your e-health, or for your Google and Amazon. And in addition, states have the opportunity to create something which is much safer than private companies, simply by also creating not only the digital identity, but the legal space necessary to keep that identity safe and unique. And this is what we did 20 years ago now.
It's amazing to think about that idea came up 20 years ago. And as you just mentioned, so many countries don't even consider this possibility. And just to make it clear, the digital ID, that's given to you at birth as a citizen. And then with that, you're able to just do every single service you need to use online is with that one ID.
Yes, first of all, I think compared to United States, in Europe in general, cities and governments keep closer track where the people are, what they're doing. You cannot put a child to school without having a certain address. You cannot open a bank account if you do not have an address. And cash economy, well, is more or less dead. So people anyway are pretty well counted. And state anyway knows quite a lot about their people. I think this is something which we have in Europe common. Now, next comes the question where my information is safer. If I once give my state and my city government information, for example, about my address, my children, my income levels, everything, then how this is kept safe? I think you also, if you apply for social services, you do fulfill papers. Now, you do not know, even if people say these papers are safe, you really don't know who read them. So in digital format, these papers are safer because if my government has information on my address, even that simple thing, and then somebody looks up this address, then I know it. I'm notified. Of course, if somebody looks my health data, I'm notified. And if they had nothing doing within my data set, I can sue them. Actually, government itself takes the responsibility to go to court on my behalf, and there will be a criminal case heard because somebody has been nosing in my data. So you see, it's not just that people blindly somehow trust digital services in Estonia. They have realized it's safer than analog because I will not be notified. And second, there is the legal space by the government which makes sure that, I mean, you don't nose in anybody's data. It's a big no-no and it's punished.
When we talk about, you know, a country that is so, Estonia is a country that is so heavily digitized and where people are, their identity is all online and safe and everything, at a time where the politics of the world, the wars are being fought online and this new wave of misinformation in the digital world, do you think Estonia has a role to play there from the lessons it perhaps has learned over the past 20 years of managing a state online, I guess?
Yes, Estonia already in 2007 came under cyber attack. We were able to protect ourselves then. We just framed off Estonia. So inside the country services worked, but you couldn't access from outside. And nowadays, everybody who runs any kind of digital model, the attacks rain on you all the time. But we do not yet have an international understanding how, for example, our analog law on sovereignty of a state applies in cybersphere. And that's why Estonia wants to take this discussion into the United Nations Security Council. Estonia has put itself forward to be a non-permanent member of the Security Council. And this is why we're doing it. We are a small country. We don't want to waste resources simply to be there. But we feel we have an obligation to humankind because we have taken this first bend and we realize maybe better the risks. So we are well versed in discussing how the analog law should apply in cybersphere. And we also realize that currently there is actually no international political gain to attribute the attacks. Countries do it sometimes, and the only gain you get from it is that you publicize it. And then everybody knows that this country or this, it could also be some non-governmental actor, this is attacking others. But there is no system where you could go and complain. Like if somebody forces your borders in a more conventional way, you will go to Security Council. Where would you go if you come under cyber attack? Worse, what are your rights? Can I go outside of my own territory to take out the cyber attacker? Or am I therefore, somehow touching on the other country's sovereignty? Because the attack may not come from government services, and the other country where it is coming from may declare itself digitally failed, meaning we cannot do anything with this attack. What are my rights? What are my obligations? What kind of consultations I need to hold? All this is a territory which we haven't yet quite understood. And as a digital society, first of all, we ourselves depend on it. Second, many countries ask us to help them to leapfrog similar way. And we see that with this help, and we do this also with the United Nations UNDP, and also with some other countries, for example, Estonia and Australia are on a common project in Pacific to do this. But if we help others to digitize, with this comes responsibility for making sure that we are safe, and not only technologically safe, but also legally protected in cybersphere. This is our big mission, I feel, right now in United Nations REAL.
And that's all for this week's edition of The Urbanist. The show was produced by Carlotta Rebello and it was edited by David Stevens. And to play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, a song that is a sort of tale of the city too. The title is a nod to Detroit's 8 Mile Road, which famously separates the city from the suburbs. Yes, it's Eminem with 8 Mile. Thank you for listening, city lovers.